Hi, this is Mary Ellen Bates of Bates Information Services, and today I'm picking the brain of Kim Doherty, a friend and colleague and one of the smartest people I know. Kim is founder and president of Doherty & Associates, an information strategy and content development company. She's also an adjunct faculty member for the University of Denver MLIS program, where she teaches a course on alternative career paths for LIS students and practitioners. And sometimes I'm lucky enough to guest lecture there. It's always a great class. She's the author of dozens of articles and several books on library and information science career topics, including Rethinking Information Work, A Career Guide for Librarians and Other Information Professionals, and LIS Career Sourcebook, Managing and Maximizing Every Step of Your Career. Most recently, she's been drawing on her expertise in LIS careers to provide career advising, webcasts, workshops, and content resources for LIS graduate schools and their students and alumni. Recently, Kim was telling me about an epiphany that she had about her unknown unknowns, to use a phrase popularized by Donald Rumsfeld. So I asked her if we could continue that conversation. So welcome, Kim.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thank you. So to kind of set the stage, recently you moved your business into a new strategic direction, and you had to question your assumptions about what your clients valued most about your services. So, you know, you're familiar with this market. So my question is, how did you know when to just trust your gut on what your clients would value and when to question your assumptions and start looking to your unknown unknowns?
I think I was trusting my gut when I was coming up with my sort of overview of what I would be offering, because I did know this market well, the market of graduate schools. I'd done a lot of work with them, and so I was pretty sure that I knew what their critical needs were, so what their pain points were. And then I sort of wrote that up as these are potential things that I could do. And then two things happened. One, I sent that out to a number of potential clients, and the ones who responded by asking me to do different things than I had originally identified. And so that was my first sort of heads up that maybe I didn't know as much as I thought I knew, which is sort of, you know, a recurring theme in all of our lives. But then I went to a conference, ALICE, which is the Association of Library and Information Science Educators, and I was hanging out with a lot of people who might be potential clients of mine, or they were people that I had met before, we'd met online, and so we were having very comfortable conversations where my goal wasn't so much to sell my services to these individuals, but simply to understand more clearly what their realities look like. And so our conversations weren't about, gee, I could do this for you. They were more about, you know, this is what I'm seeing in the profession. What are you seeing? What do you think? You know, if you were counseling students which direction to take their careers these days in terms of, you know, courses you might suggest they take or those kinds of things, what does this look like for you? And then out of that, once they begin talking more about their realities and their perceived pain points from their perspective rather than mine, then I started realizing that although I think I was correct to offer a broad range of services, I am not nearly as confident in my ability to identify which of my services people will need. Because two things emerged from those conversations. One was how differently the direct deans and directors were looking at student needs than I was, because I essentially come at it as a faculty member rather than a director of a program. And two, how different each program is in terms of its own circumstances, its own stakeholders, which might, depending on the program, it might be that they have a very powerful board, or they have a very powerful faculty group, or they have a very powerful alumni group, or the power dynamics in academia can be sort of extremely varied. So again, another unknown for me that initially was an unknown was how different everybody's circumstances would be. I hadn't realized that, and it has changed how I approach this now.
Wow. So sort of stepping back one step first, when you set up these meetings for your contacts that were going to be attending the conference, how did you set it up in a way that it didn't sound like it was going to be a sales pitch of you talking about your set of services and how you might help them? How did you make it feel, you know, like something they'd want to say yes to besides
right.
just
it started
of
off
talking
by,
to you?
It started off by saying, let's meet in the bar.
Whatever works, right?
Right. That, you know, if it involves food, that's good. If it involves alcohol, that was even better. And that certainly encouraged a very wide-ranging and relaxed conversation, I would have to say. But usually the way I approached it was, again, with no agenda, but it was usually people that I had in some way connected with in advance online. So, for example, I had been a guest speaker for a course in their program, or we had served on a virtual committee together, or I had reached out to them on some other topic. And so because we had that initial conversation, or they were in a LinkedIn group that I manage, and I checked that to see who was in that LinkedIn group, what I was looking for was, what's a factor that we have in common that isn't about us necessarily working together, but more about the two of us being in the same profession and being interested in the well-being of that profession and the success of the people who are coming into it, i.e. the students. So my outreach was about, it would be great to connect at the conference. Let's go grab a drink after your presentation or my presentation or whatever. And then because we were just kind of saying, we're both agreeing to just chat and get to know each other and hear each other's stories and that sort of thing, it diffuses the need to drive the conversation in a specific way. And that means that I can just ask lots of questions that are essentially, tell me your story. You know, tell me about the program. You know, how did you get in that job? Did you always want to be a director of a program? What are the things you're most concerned about? You know, if you were going into the profession again today, what would you be looking at in terms of a professional direction? So my goal was to get to know whoever I was talking to as a person, as an individual first, as a fellow LIS professional second, and then as a director of a program third. That's the way my interests go. That's the way I'm most comfortable having a conversation. But also, if I were then going to pitch, you know, here are products and services I can deliver, I'd much rather have already laid the face-to-face groundwork of building a personal relationship with that person and then connecting via email or a phone call or whatever with an, oh, by the way, I'm going to be doing this kind of a workshop. Would you like me to do one for you? Because I think doing it the other way, first coming in with the, I'm going to be doing this kind of a workshop for this client, I think it would work well for you guys as well, if you try to do that without having first established that personal relationship, I don't think it works as well. It's, at least it doesn't for me personally, and I don't think it would for the kind of potential clients I work with. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And what I think is interesting is you're able to establish those personal connections before you even meet them because of the other work that you do. You're not just a random person. They know you because you volunteered to be on a committee or because you agreed to speak at their event or something else where you were contributing to the profession, and that's the context in which they know you. So
I think that's absolutely correct, and it is absolutely critical. If potential clients first get to know you as a fellow professional who is willing to invest for no money in the well-being of whatever profession you're in, that really changes the nature of the relationship.
I can see why. Any thoughts on techniques or tips for just keeping your contact thinking expansively during the conversation so that, you know, you don't get lost in the weeds or into details that aren't going to move you forward? Any way to just so that you can glean as much as you can from them without it feeling like it's an interrogation on your part?
Right. I think that's a good question. And it's with some people, I have spoken with some people where I probably have said three sentences over a three-hour period. And in those situations, I sort of surrender to my destiny and order another drink and just let people sort of range wherever they would like to range, because it becomes pretty clear that that's what they enjoy doing. And so you're just going to let them do that as part of that establishing the relationship. But with people who there's more of a give and take in the conversation, a lot of times I'll ask them sort of higher level questions, a bridging question from down in the weeds for example, we're launching this class next quarter or next semester, would bridge into a question about, so tell me why you brought that particular type of curriculum into the program. What are you seeing in the future for students? To get them up again to sort of a higher level so I can understand more effectively how they want the program to grow and what they want for their students. So I would say what you're looking for there is kind of bridging questions that acknowledge where they are, what they're talking about at that moment, but then bridge them into a question that maybe takes them up a higher level or in a related direction, but maybe a different direction that allows them to share more information. I guess my goal is to use a conversation to understand the very best that I can both my client, i.e. a dean or a director, and how they see their universe. And so that is a combination of both sort of in the weeds questions, how did you end up in this job, and then higher level questions of almost a SWOT analysis. You know, if you look at the profession, what are you seeing for students as their strengths and weaknesses and threats and opportunities? Those kinds of questions, I think, enable whomever you are talking to really, I would say, think about and comment on their own reality and the reality of their clients, i.e. their students.
So I guess the thing to always keep in the back of your mind is how can I learn more about how they see the world so that
exactly.
you can see the world through their point of view.
Exactly. And of course, that's when you really realize your unknown unknowns, is when they say something and you think, whoa, I had no idea that was the case. Or it takes you into an area where you have so little knowledge that you realize this is something you've missed, that there's a direction or a thread developing that you didn't have on your radar. And so you're sort of taking mental notes, but those are some of the best opportunities, because then you learn in a situation like that. You don't need to say, oh my gosh, I had no clue that was the case. You just want to go, isn't that amazing how that's working? And make a mental note to follow up on it. But you're right. You do want to have that in the back of your mind. And the thing that I found most effective is not to be good at talking to people so much as get better at asking questions that allow them to talk. That, to me, is the way I learn more, is to listen very carefully, find areas of connection, respond in a connecting statement of, oh, right, I ran into that same issue when I was teaching 10 years ago or 5 years ago or whatever, so that you're confirming that other person, but then also ask them another question to, you know, when they get tired of talking, they'll start asking you questions. But it's both a fun way to get to know people by asking more questions than you're talking, but it's also, if you ever want to have a potential client relationship with them, it gives you an incredible wealth of knowledge. It also gives you something that I find to be very helpful, which is it gives you enough information to understand future touch points with this person. For example, a gentleman that I spoke with when I was at the Elise Conference, who's a new dean of a program at a Midwestern college, delightful guy. We had a really fun but very short conversation. But during that conversation, he was talking with great pride about some recent strides that the university had made. And it was one of the reasons that he was so excited to be taking on this job, leading the MLIS program. And this past weekend, there was in the New York Times an article about two schools that are doing incredibly innovative things to help their students succeed and graduate. And one of those two colleges was his. And so because we'd had that conversation, that was a trigger point between us that I knew was important to him. So I emailed him and said, you know, really enjoyed seeing you, saw this in the New York Times today, and it made me realize why you would be so proud to work with this school. I can see why you would want to take this job, and that's really, really cool. So if you're looking at building a relationship with a client, which from my perspective is how you have a long-term business build, one of the things you're looking for is how can you have connecting points with them that don't involve asking them for work, that don't involve touting your own skills, and that do involve saying, I paid attention to who you are and what you said and what's important to you, and here's a way I can help support that or acknowledge that. Those are the kinds of things that I'm looking for when I'm in a conversation like this.
That makes perfect sense. In fact, I'm thinking of some of the conversations I've had with people who are representing the industry or the field I'm looking at getting into. And I've noticed that one thing that keeps me focused during a conversation is to look for something that's going to surprise me. I want to get out of that conversation having learned something that just smacked me upside the head, because that's something I probably know that most people don't know.
I think that's a really good point. Because usually when you're working with clients, if you can help them grow in their understanding of their own field, because you do pick up that kind of knowledge, it makes you incredibly valuable. And for good reason. I mean, it's not just that they should hire you, it's that you may be in a unique position to see things as an outsider to that profession that other people wouldn't see because they're in it. That's one of the cool things that we bring, I think, as consultants and strategists and people who are independents and are lending our expertise to our clients, is that we have a very different perspective that may bridge their field, their profession, their industry, as well as maybe three other ones that we've also worked in and or also know about. So that, as an example, I'm from Colorado and I'm watching the cannabis industry. And what I'm watching for is what's called an industry roll-up, because I'm also from the cable television industry, where when I first worked in it, there were 400 cable television companies, and then it went through an industry roll-up, which meant that about four major providers emerged and started rolling up or purchasing all of the small mom and pops. And if you've seen things like that happen in one industry, you bring that knowledge to other industries as well. And that can happen for any industry. It may not be an industry roll-up, but it may be that you've worked in the media industry, and now you're moving into the healthcare industry. And so you bring lessons learned in the media industry to your perception and framing of, say, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats in the healthcare industry. So to your point, the more aha moments you have, the more value you can add, but also the deeper and broader your expertise becomes in how you can frame what you're seeing.
And the wonderful thing is that it's all through just a conversation where you're letting the other person talk.
Absolutely. And for those of us who are introverts, that makes it a lot easier because I'm just, you know, if someone asks me a question, I can respond, but I'm not real chatty. I'm not real talkative. So for me to have to carry a conversation on my own would be very, very difficult for me. I would probably run out of steam after about 15 minutes max. But if instead, because I'm actually interested in people and what they think and how they think and those kinds of things, if instead I show up simply with curiosity and an innate interest in what the other person thinks about stuff, then the questions sort of come very comfortably. And I think that approach especially works better for introverts. And quite frankly, also, most people like to be asked questions about what they think about things.
And they're thoughtful questions, and you're reflecting back your perspective that you've picked up from other people, too. So
yes,
they're always picking up a you know, some nugget of information as well. It's never a one-way street.
That certainly is my goal. And usually that does happen. I hope it happens all the time. But yes, you do want that give and take. And the more that you can contribute to the other person's knowledge, the better it is. And again, that comes from the more different viewpoints or perspectives you can bring into a conversation.
Perfect. Any last thoughts on this topic, on how to spot your unknown unknowns and explore them with prospective clients?
I would say to get involved in as many questions as you possibly can. If you already know a lot of clients in your field, sit down with them and just ask them, you know, what am I missing? Why would you do this or not do this? Would this be valuable or why wouldn't it be valuable? One of the biggest questions I think you can ask is, why wouldn't this be valuable? Because if you think it would be, and your potential client doesn't think it would be, that means you don't know as much as you thought you knew. So I would sort of default into anyone who's thinking about launching a new product or service or going after a new market, go ahead, you know, sort of rough in, and this is design thinking, rough in what you think you know and sort of describe what that would be, and maybe start a website and put up some content, and then start talking to people and ask as many open-ended questions as you can to start getting a better sense of the landscape. And then as you start building those relationships, ask more targeted questions. And if you already have those relationships, you know, ask them off the bat. But the biggest one I would ask is, why wouldn't this be valuable? Because you're looking for answers that tell you you have a misassumption, that you haven't vetted your assumptions. You've simply taken them for granted, which generally we all do. That, you know, if I think this is important, and here's why it would be important, and so rationally and logically, A follows, you know, that you have A from A to B to C. So it's easy. Of course it makes sense. And so they would look at it exactly the same way I do. Absolutely not. That, you know, that's like my first whop upside the head is, just because it looks like this to you from your vantage point does not have any impact whatsoever on how it looks to someone else. So I think you go in with a let's run it up the flag idea, but then just start talking to people and seeing what they value, or what they say, you know, we don't care about this thing much at all, but this other thing over here, we really, really need.
So it sounds like it really, we have to approach this as an iterative process.
Absolutely.
It's always starting with what we know and then testing it and seeing where we're wrong.
Absolutely.
And modifying accordingly.
Mm-hmm. I think the thing that it sort of boils down to for me, having recently gone through this and realized how much I didn't know about my unknowns, was come up with an idea, sort of, you know, shape it and put some parameters around it so you could describe it, and then start vetting your assumptions. Because when you put together an idea for a product or a service, you are making some assumptions about what you think your market will value and pay for. And you don't want to invest any more time, energy, or money into that product or service until you've vetted those assumptions. And you need to be open to people not only say, oh yeah, that's nice, but I wouldn't pay you money for that, but also saying, oh, you know how to do this thing over here? Because this came out in this sort of expansive conversation. That's actually the thing we're desperate for. And we would pay you money for that. Well, if you haven't invested time, energy, and ego and money in something based on your untested assumptions, it's very easy to pivot and respond to your market opportunity from this other vantage point or this other perspective.
before you get too attached to your own ideas of what right. your market value is.
And I think you used a great phrase there, which is before you get too attached to your own idea. Because I've worked for a number of startups where literally millions of dollars were invested. I didn't say thrown away. I'm sure they were important investments. But they were invested in a founder's attachment to the product or service he wanted to take to market. And when the market basically ignored that product or service, we had blown millions of dollars, and the owner was unwilling to shift into a related market opportunity because he was too attached to the one that he had come up with. I've seen that happen 3 different times now. There's a great book out called The 4 Steps Either to the Epiphany or of the Epiphany. And the premise of the book is that if you get startup capital, you should never, ever invest a dime of that capital into a product or service until you have invested, I think it's 10%, into developing the market, which means understanding the market. You know, piloting prototypes of potential products and services, taking them to the market, seeing what the market says, taking that feedback. You don't actually commit to anything until you have tested every assumption in the marketplace for that product or service. And only then do you invest the rest of your capital, that startup fund, to create that product or service. Because what usually happens is people spend 95% of their startup capital building that idea that the founder was so attached to and was so positive was for the market that he saw, and then they spend 5% trying to beat the salespeople into selling the damn thing when nobody wants it. I think your point of being overly attached to a market product or service or even a market is a really good one. It's easy to do, and it's really, really damaging.
Whew. Kim, thank you so much. I've learned so much from just listening to you. This has been really interesting. I've been talking with Kim Doherty of Doherty & Associates. You can find out more about Kim at Doherty Associates, and that's DORITY associates.com. Thank you so much, Kim.
My pleasure. Good luck to everybody.